Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. Welcome to Volume 69 in the Brecan What's On Information Sessions, a series of talks by an array of inspirational, informative and entertaining guest speakers. The What's On series has been produced for people with gynecological or breast cancer, their families and friends. This session was recorded on 24th of June 2011 at the Brecan Resource Centre, located at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre in Melbourne's CBD. Dr. Jackie Cherguin is Board Chairperson of the Australian New Zealand Breast Cancer Trials Group, as well as a medical oncologist at Box Hill and Maroondah Hospitals. The Australian New Zealand Breast Cancer Trials Group conduct innovative research programs which rigorously and scientifically test new breast cancer treatments through the conduct of clinical trials. Jackie talks about what's involved in a clinical trial and the ethics, administration and protocols you need to consider when deciding whether to participate in a clinical trial. We hope you enjoy this session, Clinical Trials.
Thanks very much, Jackie, too.
Oh, that's all right. Well, thank you. I'm sorry I'm late. I think Brecan probably knows I'm always late. I always try to do... Well, I have this idea that I can fit more into my time than actually I can. So it's actually my fault. It's not anything other than that. So I actually think that perhaps what I'm going to end up speaking about might seem a bit technical to you, and it may well be that Leslie will give you a better sense of what being on a clinical trial is all about. But hopefully between us anyway, we can give you some good information that makes you feel knowledgeable about it if you're ever offered a trial, and perhaps helps you to decide whether you want to be involved. And very much I hope that it will at least make you not immediately be scared of the idea of being in a clinical trial. Okay, so I usually these days start off with this is my garden. And I've broken the talk up with a few pictures of my garden as we go along. We had it open in autumn, and this is just the autumn gone, and we raised nearly $10,000 for breast cancer research. So these are the things that I thought I would talk about. First of all, just some meaning of some things, some definitions. I think a lot of jargon is spoken about in medicine generally, but also in particular in clinical trials, which makes it very off-putting. Then there's a bit of history. I think the history is interesting, and I can tell you some quite horrific stories of what people used to do when they were trying to do clinical trials. But thankfully, most of those things are well and truly in the past. Hopefully, all of them are well and truly in the past. They have given rise, of course, to a lot of regulations around clinical trials, which we often think of as a complete pain. It's a lot of paperwork and red tape and stuff. But they are there for a good reason, and they come from those bad things that happened in the past, really. The thing that you guys will have the most to do with is this patient information and consent form, and so we'll talk a bit about that. I'm not sure, what did I mean? Oh, questions, that's right. Questions is what you might want to ask your doctor about if you have been offered a clinical trial. So just some ideas there. And then just a few things about what we've achieved with doing clinical trials and some statistics on things that have improved. So hopefully we won't get too bogged down with time. Let's move along. So a clinical trial is research in which a therapeutic, so a treatment, or a preventive, so something which is aimed to prevent something, or a diagnostic intervention is tested in humans. And now this is a slide to just illustrate the difference between a clinical trial and laboratory research. And I think sometimes that gets a bit lost in the media and things. Often it's all talked about as research and trials and things. For a new treatment to be developed, obviously it has to start in the laboratory, and sometimes that takes a really, really long time. The first thing that's done is what we call in vitro, so that's in test tubes and tissue cultures and things. Then there's testing in animals, and then there's clinical trials. You move on. Now, clinical trials are divided up into different phases. And so I'll just run through what these phases are. Phase one is the first part of testing in humans. And often these are done either in healthy people who are happy to try out something, or in patients with certain diseases where there really aren't any treatment options for them. So it's not often something that you get the opportunity to be involved in. The purpose of the phase one is to check up particularly on the safety of giving these treatments in humans and what sort of side effects they get. That's what we mean by tolerability. Sometimes the studies are also designed to actually investigate in very much detail how the body handles the drugs. So it'll take blood tests to take levels and things like that. So sometimes it's quite hard work being in a phase one trial. And most of the time, actually, there isn't ending up being a benefit for the patients. There might be if they've come up against one that turns out to be a useful and effective treatment. So it's certainly only a small proportion of times when this might be relevant to breast cancer patients. So this is the first place where we might get some idea that the new treatment is actually effective. So phase two, now these are more commonly around and available to breast cancer patients. This is when we already have a fair amount of information on how humans manage the drug. We know a bit about the side effects and we're pretty certain that they're reasonably safe, but we want to gain further information about that, and then we want to also gain further information about how effective the treatment is. And this is actually the stage of testing of a new treatment where it's most likely to fail if it's going to fail. At this point, it doesn't get passed here. Now, this is the type of trial that is much the most common one, especially in the breast cancer realm, where a treatment has got quite a bit of a track record already, but we want to know how it compares to what we would be normally using as our gold standard treatment. So these trials are randomized, and that means that, and I'll come to that word in a minute or two, but it means that people will either get the new treatment or get what we would normally be doing, so what we'd call our standard treatment. And this is considered the definitive way of assessing a drug, and a lot of these studies are done for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and have to be very, very carefully regulated in order to really prove the value of a new treatment. The other thing just to mention, because I'll come back to it, is that this is a sort of a trial where we can actually start to measure the sort of risk to benefit ratio. So in terms of risk, I mean the downsides, the side effects, the bad things that might happen as a result of a treatment versus the benefit, and you can get a handle on whether that's a good ratio, and obviously we'll want the benefit to far outweigh the risks. But so this sort of a trial can help us to look at that as well. So next slide. Look, so these are not terribly exciting trials, these phase four trials. And we actually don't get involved in very many of them, but they do have their place. They help with finding out a bit more about perhaps rarer side effects, particular issues in special populations, for instance, perhaps in pediatrics or in pregnancy or just different indications that the drug had not been used in before. So it can provide some useful information, but it's not usually one of the ones that gets offered to breast cancer patients very often. So move along. So I, when I was putting this all together, I thought to myself about the fact that we do use a lot of words that may not make sense to people who are not medically trained. And I think jargon is a good term for them. And jargon, of course, is any word or talk or writing that one does not understand, and one would often think of it as gibberish. I was told once, and I haven't got any data to support this, but I have heard that the size of the vocabulary for medical terminology is equivalent to a whole language. I don't know if that's really true, but anyway, because I'm useless at languages. But anyway, I move along. So some nice little thoughts there with jargon feeling a bit like blah, 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 blah. So the next little section is going to just tell you what some of the words mean that are related to clinical trials. So the first word is protocol. Now, protocol is actually usually a thick document, maybe an inch thick or more, which outlines all the details about the study and how it's planned that we will carry it out. And the reason that so much is written, well, there's lots of reasons, actually, but one of them is to make sure that we safeguard the health of the participants. And the other very important thing is that we've designed it in such a way that we actually will be able to answer the specific questions we want to answer. Now, the first thing that needs to be thought about if a person's going to be going into a clinical trial is, are they what we call eligible? So eligibility criteria, so the factors that determine whether a person's situation is appropriate for the trial. And we have criteria that they have to fulfill, which are called inclusion criteria. And then there are criteria that they must not have any of, which are called exclusion criteria. And the sorts of things we're looking here is the characteristics of the patient, so that may be their age, whether they've had menopause or not, and their other health issues, and also then the disease. So the in case of breast cancer, you know, what sort of stage the cancer's at and that sort of thing. So this word randomised, which we mentioned already, this is part of phase 3 studies as a routine, and in fact sometimes is part of phase 2 studies as well. And what it means is to allocate quite randomly, literally like picking a piece of paper out of a hat which says on it either treatment A or treatment B, and you can get that it's completely outside of anybody's control which one you end up picking out. And that's what we mean by randomly allocate to one treatment or another. And sometimes there's more than two options in a trial, and that starts to make it feel a little bit more confusing. Sometimes we have four options. Now, the reason that we do it in this random fashion is to reduce the bias that might occur if a person chose their own treatment, because it might be that all the ladies who knew a certain thing about their cancer will choose treatment A, and a different factor might have made people choose treatment B, and that would mean we wouldn't get a valuable result, because the result might well have been influenced by why people chose. So it's very important to do this in a randomised fashion. Now, one of the things about trials is that these randomised trials, is that we need what we call a control arm. Now, a control arm is the group that are allocated to whatever is considered to be the standard treatment at that time, and it might be a treatment, but it actually might be a placebo, because there might not be any standard treatment. And placebo, I'll come to in a moment, but is a no treatment essentially. So this having a control arm is vital, and also it's sort of considered a standard by which experimental observations are evaluated. Yes. Yes, absolutely. One of the things you may not end up knowing, though, is which arm you've been put on. But there will always be information that says the options that you might be allocated to are A and B, or A, B, C and D, and you would know. Yes. Now, that wouldn't be ethical, and it wouldn't be allowed if that wasn't considered reasonable for your situation. So that would only happen if currently, if you didn't go in the trial, you wouldn't receive anything at all. Okay, that makes sense? Yeah? Okay. Move on. So this is the word used if you don't get to know what you're being allocated, and your doctor doesn't get to know either. I've put double blind there, and that means the doctor and the patient don't get to know. Single blind is just the patient doesn't get to know. But it's usually, if it's going to be blinded, it's double blind. And the purpose of this is actually also, again, to remove biases and assumptions. Because, you know, if the doctor knows, or even if the patient knows that you're on a certain treatment, there'll be expectations. And you may have all heard of this thing called placebo effect. So as a patient, you might feel better because you're expecting to feel better. And you might even be biased as the doctor reporting that and thinking, well, this person's on this treatment, so I'm sure they are feeling they look a bit better. And that's not very scientific. So that's why they often are double blind. So move along. And here we are, we've already mentioned placebo. So it's an inactive treatment, or it's not really a treatment, but it's an inactive sham, if you like, which looks exactly the same as the treatment. So if it's a pill, it's just a pill that's been manufactured to look the same. If it's a drip or an injection, it will look and feel exactly the same. And so therefore it's a very unbiased way of measuring whether having the treatment is better than having nothing at all. Okay. And we also mentioned this term a little bit before as well, the risk-benefit ratio. And this is referring really to the risk the individual might experience versus the potential benefits. So, for instance, is having this drip, which might potentially cause me to have an infection, worth that risk if it's going to provide me with a 50% chance, better chance of being cured? Well, yes, probably it is. But if I've got a 50% chance of dying from this treatment, it's only going to improve my chances by 55% of not dying from the cancer, then it's probably not worth it. So this is this thing which will come into your decision making about whether you want to do a trial, which we'll move along to in a moment. And I hope that landed and made sense. You want to say something? No, I think it probably helps to clarify, so I'm okay. Well, it's a good question to particularly bring it up here, because I think, and I'm going to criticise a bit later, what's tended to happen to these patient and information consent forms is that there's an awful lot of information provided about risk, which is because it has to be, that's the rules. But actually, the amount of information provided about benefit is always played down quite a lot. And the reason for that is because it's because it's sensed that if we play up or even maybe just talk about them in a reasonable fashion, the benefits, it might be looked as coercion. You know, if you do this, then you will get X, Y, and Z. So please do it. You better do it. And that sort of stuff. So I think the information should be there, but you may find that there is a bit of a bias towards making it look very unpleasant and very risky, when in fact, when you talk to your treating team, they will be able to give you a better balance on it and say, well, actually, look, the benefits are this. So we can see that they've written a lot about these risks, but if you actually really analyse them, there's only a very small chance of those issues, whereas the chance of benefiting is going to be 10% or 20% or whatever it might be. Yeah, and it's also a bit about gut feeling as well, because different people will think different risks are worse. They'll put more weight on losing their hair than somebody else will. So it's your risk and your benefit, what you perceive the value of those are. So there's no numbers. And that's where it gets really difficult. Yeah. I know. And look, I know I'm breaking off, but I think it's a thing to say that quite often when we want people to enter a trial, because that's the time when it needs to be decided, is absolutely the worst time for that patient, because they have so many other things happening too, which is a pity, because the only reason the doctors are going to offer it to you is because it may be a benefit to you. Unless it's a certain type of a trial, in which case they need to tell you that this is actually for information, guiding something different in the future, and will not be of benefit to you. So occasionally there are trials that are like that. We've got a little study going at the moment that I don't think really could be argued to be any real benefit to the patients. It's actually a study to look at how taste is affected by chemotherapy. And it involves a little bit of time commitment from the patients to answer some questions and have their taste tested by the dietitian at different points during their treatment. So it's not going to influence what happens to them. It's certainly not going to be helpful in their treatment. But people seem to be quite interested in it, so that's a plus. And it's helpful in the long run, yes. The first thing to say is that it's probably more common for the setup to be able to do a clinical trial to be available within a public hospital, and much less so in a private hospital. Not completely the case. There are a number of places where they do the trials in the private system. So one of the factors will be which oncologist, or if it's not an oncology trial, which surgeon is your doctor? Are they interested in the trials, and are they likely to refer you to do them? And if they, that's probably the main sticking block rather than the public-private issue. And it is a thing that I think we'd like to teach the general public, that whenever they need to think about treatment for something like breast cancer, they should be asking their doctor, is there a clinical trial that I could go on? And maybe even be a bit pushy about it if the doctor says, oh, no, we don't do clinical trials here. Well, maybe could I see somebody who could tell me about that? That's if you want to do something like that. But so I think it's probably the doctor you come across more than anything. And the doctor won't be fussed at all talking to you. To be honest, whether you're a private patient or a public patient doesn't matter to the doctor in terms of whether you're suitable for clinical trial. So this comes to the process of informed consent. Now, to do any trial, obviously we need to inform as best we can the patient so they know what they're thinking about, they know what they're taking on, they know the risks and benefits of it. And then they do have to sign a form. I think that it's always important to spend a bit of time. We sometimes have patients, particularly ones actually that do already know us, and at some point during their follow-up, they it's an opportunity to be in a trial, and they'll say, oh yeah, I'll do that, and they don't read it or anything, and they just sign it because they've got very used to the people looking after them, and they realise that, well, if the doctor says that might be good for me, then yeah, I'll do that. I don't particularly like that. I think it's really important, if possible, to go away at least and think about it overnight. Now, what else have I written here? I think it's important not only to be given a letter or, you know, the information form, but also to be able to have quite a good discussion. Now, quite often my process, and I'm not sure it's necessarily the right process, is to have a brief initial discussion, give the information, and then get back for a fuller discussion. And sometimes that's also with our research nurse, who's particularly good at talking to people about the trials. So that we try to give people the opportunity to really understand what they're taking on and have their questions answered. So the document describes not only the downside and the risk, but it does talk about the rights. It talks about things like privacy and confidentiality of your information. It tells you who you can contact if there are problems. It should be telling you how long you'll be involved in the trial and what frequency you have to do things, what sort of procedures you have to do. Also should describe to you why the trial is being done. What are we trying to find out about by doing the trial? So you should feel that you know all of those sorts of things when you have a think about a trial. Move on. So that signifies that I'm going to change to another topic, a bit more of the garden. So this is just some of the terrible things that happened in the past century that made it quite clear that we have to really, really regulate how we look after clinical trials. And some of you may know some of these stories. The Nuremberg war crimes are probably the most famous, with the horrendous things that the Nazis did to their prisoners of war. It's just absolutely unthinkable. So I won't mention any particular because it makes me upset. The next one's pretty awful too. I don't know if you know about this, but in America, some very poor, I think they probably were even homeless people, were given food and I think lodging in exchange for being in this syphilis study. And a large proportion of the men in the study were did have already syphilis when they entered the study. And it, the intention was to find out the natural history of syphilis. And that was fine in 1930. But in 1947, penicillin was the standard treatment for syphilis. These people were followed up until 1972 and never, ever given the opportunity to have penicillin. So not only did they have terrible consequences of their syphilis, they passed the syphilis on to their wives, some of the children, and it just kept on going until somebody blew the whistle. It's unthinkable that other human beings could, you know, you could do that to other human beings, especially as a medical professional, because you're trained to be there to help look after people. Just shocking. Oh. What else have they done? The Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital, they injected cancer cells into well people. But they were... What people were they? I think they were... They were frail and elderly, not well people, who had very little say in what went on. They were being cared for, I think, in an institution, and they were just being told that they were just doing a little experiment because they had just had this little injection. So there was no proper explanation or consent. And the Willowbrook one was mentally retarded children were given hepatitis. Henry Beecher wrote a fabulous article in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1966, and I think he's probably the person who should be credited with turning this around and getting us towards actually having proper regulations. Although, if you move along, that's just to say that this is what the ethics is all about, is really to make it ethical and appropriate behaviour, how we look after clinical trials. I want to move on. So, but Nuremberg did precipitate the Nuremberg Code, which was not law, but it had a good think about what was important in looking after people safely on trials, along the lines of informed consent being appropriate, and that any trial that was planned had to be going to be worth finding out. Some of the things they did in Nuremberg were not worth finding out. You know, they were things like freezing people and awful things. Justice or fairness and equal opportunity to participate or not to participate. So that was the very beginning of something coming out of Nuremberg. And then in 1964, there were some ethical principles put together. But in 1966, Beecher brought this put this article out, and I think that has helped things to continue to evolve. And if we turn along to the next one, the other part of the regulations as they've developed is not just the ethics of it, which I've covered quite a lot of, but it's actually we've got to really ensure that what we do is worth doing. In other words, that the data we produce are credible. So we have to make sure we have really good systems for reporting accurately, interpreting accurately, and we have a lot of quality assurance systems in place. So that's just, sorry, an aside, really. I think I've slotted those slides in the wrong place. Move along. In the last 10 to 15 years, there are quite a number of different regulations that have been developed in different countries, and these two here are the Australian regulations, which very much reflect international regulations, and they look after the ethics and the proper conducting of the trials so that we get good robust results that are worth having. So hopefully that was the worst section of it, because it's horrible, that section, but anyway, we can move on now. So, to some extent, we might say, as a researcher anyway, that the pendulum has swung to the opposite end of all of those bad things that happened last century, in that perhaps we've got too much red tape and too much information. And some people who've read information forms as patients, which go on for 25 or 30 pages, might well agree, because it's very difficult to really get the gist of it and actually what you need to get out of it. It's just gone over the top. In detail, and as I've already mentioned, there's an excessive focus on risks and a lack of detail on benefits, and we've already talked about having opportunity to discuss with your treating team, which is really important. Move along. So I put down a few reasons why there could be good value in being a clinical trial, and then I've got some reasons why, in fact, clinical trial might not be for you. So probably the first one there is the most appealing to patients often, and that is that the new treatment on offer may provide some benefit, and it might not be otherwise available, but only in the trial. There's also some research that suggested that patients in clinical trials have better outcomes. It may just be that the doctors that are looking after the patients in clinical trials are just paying more attention to detail, that sort of thing that ends up converting into actually people doing better. And it may be that if you're treated by that same doctor without being in a clinical trial, you may do as well. So it's a little bit unclear, but there is at least some suggestion that if you are in a clinical trial, you can be pretty sure that you're getting the best treatment that you possibly can. It certainly ensures that your treatment is either gold standard or cutting edge. And we've said about maybe providing better medical care with more intensive monitoring. Sometimes a situation arises where if you're in a trial which you got allocated the control arm, if the trial starts to get results which show that that treatment that the other half of the people in the trial got is beneficial, you may be one of the first people to actually be able to get that treatment. That's particularly happened with Herceptin, in fact, that the people who were originally in the trials and had been allocated not to receive Herceptin, when it became obvious that the Herceptin was valuable, those patients were offered the opportunity to have it. Even though it was delayed, it was thought it was very reasonable for them to have that opportunity. So sometimes you might not get the opportunity initially, but it actually opens doors for you in the future. Now, the other thing I think is that just from the process of being in a clinical trial, it may help you learn more about your condition in general. You become more knowledgeable, so that can be a plus. And then there's always the fact that you can be proud of contributing to future generations of people, the altruism of being in a clinical trial. You want to move on? The downside. Well, you don't have a say in what you get, and a lot of people find that a bit disconcerting. And you may not know which treatment you're on. You may well need to have extra hospital tests and visits. And the new treatment actually may not turn out to be any better than the old. It may also have worse side effects. I've already said when. Oh! No, it isn't actually. It's the way I made the slides, because I couldn't make my PowerPoint make new slides that had the same thing at the bottom, so I copied the last one and then I'd write some new stuff. And I did it rather late at night, and I think probably that one didn't get finished. No, I think we better move on, because I think we've done that. So, this is the big question. This is the crux of it all. How do you decide? Well, I've already said that you'll want to balance the risks and the possible benefits. And for example, if there's a lot to gain, it may be reasonable to take some risk. If the potential gain is small and the risks are very, very tiny, that also may be quite an easy decision. But if the benefit is not large or the risks are quite significant, you're going to probably have a bit more of a trouble in deciding. And I don't really think there's a solution or a formula by which you can always make a decision. But those are the sort of factors to be trying to weigh up. And this is where I was going to break and let Leslie talk a bit about how, well, her experience with her breast cancer and how she thought about being in a clinical trial. Now, I'm going to move on after that to probably some questions, although Leslie might bring quite a lot of those up. Oh, okay, you go over there. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Just a bit of background on me. I was first diagnosed with breast cancer in 1998, and Jackie was my oncologist. At that stage, I had a mastectomy, 3 months of chemotherapy. So
you had AC four cycles, probably. Yeah.
I elected to have intensive radiotherapy and so everything was going along swimmingly. I was offered tamoxifen. Late 2006, I started to lose weight, but I'd had so long, I kind of put it down to stress and all the rest of it. Didn't feel so long again. Then I found a lump in my neck, and I went to an oncologist, not Jackie. And I was actually misdiagnosed, which I was really angry about. But anyway, cut a long story short, I ended up having scans, and it was revealed that I had secondaries in my liver and in my bones. So that was all panic station, oh my God, fairly devastated, as you can imagine, as Jackie will testify. I was totally devastated. So I was in Jackie's office, and she was giving me the bad news. And she said, you will have 6 months of chemo.
Oh, no, this is, I'm trying to save life. You will.
You can have 6 months of chemo. Well, I just don't know. And she said, by the way, there is a trial starting at Boxall Hospital. Jackie was still working at Boxall at that stage. Are you interested? And I did not hesitate for 1 second. I said, definitely want to hear, at least hear about it. So, in fact, I think that very day after my appointment with you, I went down with my family to meet the research trial coordinator, Pamela. And she basically just gave me all the information, outlined what was involved in the trial. She said, here's the... actually, I don't think it was very many pages, probably less than 10 pages I had to read. She said, along with reading that, you have to have some tests. They were mainly heart tests, I think, ECG, and I had something else, it's called a gated blood pool scan. It was just to make sure that your heart is strong enough to handle any kind of drugs that they're going to give you. So I went, I had those tests, I think they actually might have been on the same day, or the next day. And then I went home and read all the information, and I decided that I wanted to do it because really I had, you know, pretty extensive cancer in my liver, and I kind of figured, well, I had nothing to lose. And also my health, apart from having cancer, I was fairly healthy. I know that sounds strange, but I didn't have any other chronic conditions. So I thought, yeah, by the bullet, do it. Basically what was involved in the trial was for a drug called Avastin, which is probably, most of you might have heard about it by now, it's been around for a while internationally for other kinds of drugs, I think mainly colon.
Yes, colon cancer, yeah.
Avastin, for those of you who don't know, it's not a chemotherapy drug, it's a targeted therapy drug, so basically it just works on the site of the tumour by cutting off the oxygen supply to the tumour. So basically, hopefully the tumour dies, it doesn't have any oxygen. The wonderful thing about a targeted therapy drug is that there are much less side effects usually, because the chemotherapy is attacking every blood cell in your body. With Avastin and similar drugs, you've got monoclonal nuclear antibodies.
She's doing a really good job here, by the way, everybody. I'm very impressed.
Avastinumab is its actual name, the drug. It only targets that one area, so you're not feeling, you don't feel like you get hit by a truck, basically. So, sorry, that was the same category of that.
Yes. It's got a different target, but it's got the same process in that it targets particular cells.
So the trial involved, it was a double-blind trial, as Jacob was explaining, so if Jackie didn't know, I didn't know if I was going to block which particular drug that was on the drug or placebo. And it involved basically, for the first 6 months, I had the chemo and I was on the Avastin trial as well. So I was, every 3 weeks, I would go to Boxall Oncology Day Centre and have IV. What was the chemo on?
Taxotere, I think. Yeah. Yes, you did the film as well. I always ask Leslie to do things, and she starred in a film for us.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I was on Taxotere, and as well, I was on the trial drug. So initially, I didn't know if I was on the placebo or I was on the Avastin. I felt like crap, but that was mainly because of the chemo. And at that stage, I didn't know what the side effects of Avastin would have been. If I'd known for sure, I wouldn't know if it was the chemo or the Avastin making me feel crook. But I can now say in hindsight, it was definitely chemo because I've been on Avastin for years and I don't have the same side effects. Anyway, I went along and saw Jackie regularly and I started getting these strange side effects that weren't, that didn't pertain to chemo at all. Like, I had this constantly runny nose and I had itchy rashes and stuff like that. And after a while, it was a few months, Jackie and I both agreed, I think you're on it. So, yeah. So after my chemo was finished, I stayed on the trial. And I've been on the trial. Well, I think the trial was actually officially finished.
It is, yes.
For the Avada, it was an international trial. But the drug company, very nicely, had let me stay on the trial, which is a blessing. So while I was on, while the trial was officially going, what was involved for me was every time I went for treatment, I had to see the trial coordinator, and she would give me just a, you know, the usual test, temperature, blood pressure. I had to do a urine test because one of the biggest side effects of Avastin is that it affects your kidneys, your function of your kidneys. So I would do that every 3 weeks. Every now and again, the drug company would give me sort of a quality of life questionnaire, which I had to fill out and send back. Not a big deal. So I guess basically what I'm saying is I was monitored very, very closely.
You had to have your scans fairly often too,
yeah,
didn't
I had
you?
To have scans
yeah.
Which showed that the drug, the therapy was working, thank God. So that went on, and I can't remember exactly when the trial officially finished, maybe 2 years ago.
Something like that.
And I guess the company is still kind of overseeing the way that, like, if, for example, my cancer re-emerged in a major way, they wouldn't want to know about it. Because that, they could say, oh, well, she was on Avastin for 5 years, and her cancer came back. So, but, yeah, I have... As far as the trial people are concerned, I don't really have much to do with
that. But the plus, I think, is that Leslie's one of very few people in Australia who's been able to have Avastin because it hasn't become widely available.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, she didn't know that at the beginning, but that turned out to be a really good plus for her
being
in the trial.
It's worked brilliantly for me. The only downside is that it has, I guess because I've been on it for so long, since 07, it has affected my kidneys in that my kidneys have been damaged, but I have to be monitored very carefully. That involves, before I have my treatment, which is now monthly, I have to do a 24-hour urine test, which I'm actually doing today.
Oh! Where's your bottle?
You have to pee into a jar of work and all that kind of stuff. I love the small price to pay. So,
I think that's a good comment, though. Price to pay is actually quite a good concept to think about. Or think about how much benefit she's getting. So that price, even if that price is a bit worse, it might be worth it.
Yeah. So the 24-hour urine test basically measures how much protein is being excreted in my urine. It's over Serene, who is my oncologist now, she has said if it's 2 grams or over, I can't have any Avastin. And actually last month it was 2.2 or something like that. So I didn't have my treatment last month. I just had the Bondromate, which is a bone strengthening drug. I've had that every treatment as well since I was really diagnosed. So that's basically what I have to do, and I take my little wee specimen to the hospital after work tonight, and the lab will analyse it, and then tomorrow morning I go in at 9 o'clock and get the results, and if it's less than 2 or under, I have the
It's like Zometa. Some people might have heard of Zometa. I think you might be asking how many. Are you asking how many?
Oh, God, I can't. It was quite a lot.
It was probably about seven.
Seven, yeah.
I don't know. I'm pretty guessing, but
I didn't,
yeah.
I mean, when I was first diagnosed, I actually didn't know this at the time. It wasn't first stage breast cancer.
If it's more than four lymph glands, technically it is stage three.
Yeah. Jackie, thankfully.
Oh, well, that's good. It was thankful.
Like the bad news, you know what I mean? So I went on sort of obliviously, you know, going, oh, I only have first stage breast cancer. So if I'd actually known that, I probably would have been in the back of my mind that reoccurrence was probably.
It swings and roundabouts. It is so hugely swings and roundabouts because it's so hard to know what the best way to have your brain set, because I personally would want to just be positive and thinking, I've had early breast cancer, I'm going to be okay. That's right. Well, I don't know, we probably haven't, except that they keep giving it to her, so I don't think they'd keep giving her placebo. It varies for different trials, and it's perfectly fine to ask once the trial's finished. So, for instance, some of the hormonal trials that we've had, it's fine for us to request it now, but it doesn't come automatically. I think, in fact, if we request, I mean, it's silly because I think we know she's on Avastin, but if we had a question once the trial was finished, we would have no problem in finding out. Yeah. Part the way through in your trial, they some of the results started to come together and suggest that it wasn't as helpful to just be treated with tamoxifen and not have any letrozole. And so they felt it was important to identify all the people in the trial who'd been allocated only to the tamoxifen so that they could then have a choice to go on to letrozole if that's what they wanted. So we had about, I don't know, we had a lot of people on that trial. We probably had about 50 people on that trial, and probably only about 8 of them were on tamoxifen only. It was, for some reason, it was relatively small. And some of them, I don't think you were one, because I don't think we had that conversation. I think you were. So some of those people, they did decide to go on to letrozole, but that's what happened in the middle of your trial. So sometimes things happen in trials that some results start to come, and it's not ethical any longer to treat people on what they were originally allocated, because we now know more, and we therefore have to change what we do. Now, Leslie's trial is quite interesting because it was a little bit disappointing in the results that actually came from the trial, in that the amount of benefit that the Avastin was giving on average to the patients was really quite small.
In fact, the MGA was decided to prove it.
That's right.
For secondary
risk. And that's why it's not funded. No. That's why we're not using it here. Yeah. Yes, and I think that is the general feeling and understanding of the vast majority of people who are not involved in clinical trials. And it's a problem because, particularly, I mean, it's a little bit different for Leslie's situation because she'd become a bit more, I mean, it was still horrific because it was the time when the cancer had come back, but at least she had a little bit of grounding and knowledge about cancer. And so perhaps, I don't know, she might tell me it maybe didn't really help, but I can imagine it's really impossible. Well, not impossible, but very, very hard to come to a decision. And a lot of people do come to your decision because of exactly that, that, look, I've got plenty else to deal with. This feels risky. Why would I do it? No, let's just get on with what I have to do. Yeah. Look, it may have been a fault of whatever the process was. I don't wish to criticise, but we've been, particularly recently, with a very difficult trial that we've had that everybody didn't want to do because they felt it was very risky. It's called D-Care, and it's about an added treatment with chemotherapy to prevent the cancer coming back. But the risks in the information sheet are about 4 pages long. And, of course, people are going to think very much, oh, no, this is way too hard, especially because they'd be exactly in your position of it, already having to take on what's happened to them. So we developed a new system whereby we actually sort of make sure that we don't make any decisions with them. And luckily the trial accommodates this for several weeks, maybe even a month, that we let them digest it a bit more slowly, and we have the opportunity to actually talk to them a bit more, make sure that we really make it clear to them that what it's all about. It's still very important that we don't coerce them and make them feel that we've put all this effort in and they must go on. So that's difficult to get that balance as well. But we've been much more successful now that people have understood a bit more what the balance is between the risks and the benefits. Was it ALTO? How long ago was it? Have you had Herceptin? Yeah, I think you probably were given the opportunity of going. I'm absolutely certain, but the main trial that was for that sort of situation is called ALTO, and it's an extremely complicated trial. There's 4 arms to it, and you might get Herceptin, you might get lapatinib or ticerb, or you might get some sort of combination of the two. Yeah, but I don't think that's in adjuvant treatment. With no secondaries. Okay. After you finish your Herceptin as an adjuvant treatment, which is a bit more straightforward actually than the ALTO. You should go and ask them if you can go on that one. Yeah, it might be very suitable. You need to talk to your doctor about that, because I think we don't really know, and your doctor may end up saying, well, you've been so good on the letrozole, why don't we just go for a bit longer? But there is a trial that once you've been off the letrozole for 12 months, that we then allocate either to restart the letrozole or not, and then follow up to see if it makes a difference. Yeah, oh please, lots of questions for Leslie. Very good question. Have you signed to send tissue away? I think we've had a conversation. I've had a conversation about that, because I think that's what's really important, especially having looked after Leslie and knowing that, gee, if we knew what her tumour was like, then maybe we'd know who's going to benefit from Avastin. I don't think it's possible, actually, to link it back.
Maybe when the trial is what, maybe we're not happy.
Because they may not have actually completely analysed it yet, anyway, because they may not know what to look for just yet. And so I think sometimes these are the things that are called translational research. Yeah. I think that they often go on for a lot longer as more understanding of what the cells are doing and things happens. Yes, that's right. Yeah, it sounds like you know quite a lot about it.
I wanted to know because the two samples that were retested,
So I understand that you don't get to know that in America because you're just. But I would like to know the result of my test and my biomarkers here.
And this is being done for this neratinib trial. Yes. Yeah, right. Okay.
The tissue must be kept for a significant amount of time because when I had this familiar cancer, I tested positive for it.
Yeah.
4 to 8 months later, from the other group of people who came up, I got the notification that I had the BRCA1 mutation.
Oh.
And I rang them and I said, well, you're a bit
slow.
The two sides of people go on research.
Yes.
And communicate the facts. And I thought, well, they'd automatically pass.
You would have thought.
So the tissue was certainly...
Oh, look, it stays... Well, for certainly... Within the hospital, for instance, for your cancer, when you had it removed more than 10 years ago, there'll still be some slides and samples of tumour somewhere. Yeah, and because you've been on a trial, there'll probably be some in Switzerland as well or somewhere. Do you want to just show me the next slide so I can remember what else I've got? I don't know whether we need to go through these slides in much detail because I think we've covered a lot in our discussions, but it might just bring up a few other things if we have a quick look at them. So you've already got an idea about the fact that you can ask about what is already known about the risks and benefits of any treatment that's being tested, sort of things that we've talked with Leslie about, how much extra time do you need to commit and extra testing. This is one we haven't actually spoken about, and that is that, yes, you can withdraw from the study at any time. And I think that's really important.
That would make her
Yeah. Because that takes away a lot of worry that you feel like you've signed up for something you've got to stick to, which you absolutely don't have to. I think it's really important for everybody to remember that what is the most important thing in any trial is that the patient is getting the best care. And if it turns out that that treatment on the trial is not the best care for the patient, then we've got to stop. So that's always the case. And I think it's worth actually asking that question, how will the study benefit me? I was drawn to attention of that actually when I was telling somebody about that taste research that I was telling you about. And her first question, once I just introduced it, is how will this benefit me? And I thought that was a great question because for that particular study, there was no benefit for her. But she still ended up doing it. But she asked that question because I think it is really important. And we move along. Do you want to move on? You did? Oh, right, okay, sorry. Maybe it was another of my repeat slides, but I don't think it is. Sorry, you were going to say something? The main time when that happened was when people were buying Herceptin, which was a little bit later than that. But I think what might have happened around your time was when some people thought they should buy Taxol, which was back then a fairly fancy new chemo. Yes, that's right. That is sometimes the advantage of being on a trial, because you do get your treatment paid for. I haven't actually listed it as an advantage because I feel it's a bit of a bribery. But it can be, yeah. 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 Abraxane is an excellent chemotherapy drug. We do use it quite a lot now, and it is subsidized in breast cancer, so it doesn't cost that for the patients. It's actually related, it's not the same as, but it's related to what Leslie had, the Taxotere. And anybody who's had Taxol, it's actually a form of Taxol. Not tamoxifen, Taxol. The drug company that produces Abraxane, they are actually, I personally think, a very generous Australian company they don't make it, but they bring it in and they run its sales in Australia. Maybe she should ask and see if they'd be prepared to give it to her for a huge discount. I think they might have a special access program that might help her. It's worth asking. Yes, because it's pancreatic. So what I'm saying is because it's not in the subsidized type of cancer group, I think the people who make it, called Specialized Therapeutics Australia, they might have a program. She might have to pay $2,000 and they pay for the rest or something. The oncologist might not know because it isn't always known widely. No, but it might be worth asking the company. Oh, right, and they paid for your Herceptin? Yes. Excellent. Look, it's a big problem because it's such a stupid rule, because you're going to get the Herceptin anyway, because you'll have it after the surgery. It's not saving money for the government. It would be very beneficial for you to have it before the surgery because it works so nicely. And they've got rocks in their head, but that's the government for you. By the way, Raylene Boyle's birthday party tomorrow evening. I'm not sure who knows about that. But the Prime Minister's going to be there, and part of the purpose is to keep the pressure on about sorting out some of these things about Herceptin, for instance, and other access to other drugs. How long will I need to be followed up? Sometimes that's for ages and ages and ages. Another question to ask is about costs. Mostly costs are covered, but occasionally there are a few things which are not covered, so it's a good question. I must say, I think this is so carefully looked after, the confidential thing, you probably don't really need to ask the question, but you may want to, just to feel more comfortable. This is another really good thing in terms of a trial, working out who's running the trial, because that can give you a lot of sense of that this is okay, especially if it's run by a clinical trials group rather than a pharmaceutical company. You'll know that it's been carefully considered and worked out. I'm sure your trials are all from IBCSG, probably, which is an international trials group, because there's no financial gain for the people who've designed the trial. So they've designed the trial to answer the questions that need to be answered, rather than a pharmaceutical company that has designed it to get it registered. Now, that doesn't mean to say pharma trials are bad, necessarily. Some of them are really, really good, too, and very worthwhile. And Leslie's is a pharma trial. But it does just add sometimes to your feeling of confidence that you can know that that it's not going to be biased in that way. Another thing that I think is quite interesting for people to find out and may make them feel more happy about a trial is, well, where else is it being run? Is it all over the world? Which places are doing it in Australia? How many patients are going to be on it? How many are already on it? What experience does your doctor have with patients on the trial already is another question to ask.
I think I was the only one.
You were. We'd had a lot of difficulty finding patients suitable for the trial. We were desperate because we thought it was a really good trial. And so we're very, very proud to have a patient who's done so well. Now, the very last couple of slides, I did these in a great hurry, so I didn't think about them greatly. There are lots and lots of trials that Australian women have participated in. None of you will necessarily know the names of them, but the HERA one is the first main Herceptin study that's helped to show that the Herceptin is valuable. And I won't remember, right? Several hundred Australian women were in that. And the big one, 98, and that's helped to show the value of letrozole and that it's a little bit more valuable than tamoxifen, but not a great deal. Tamoxifen's still a really good drug. The ATAC one is the same with the Arimidex as with the letrozole trial, also showing the slight value over above tamoxifen. Now, this I should add is just for postmenopausal ladies. Premenopausal ladies, letrozole and Arimidex are not useful. It needs to be tamoxifen, and tamoxifen is very good for premenopausal ladies. So there's lots of trials, and there has been a lot of research in breast cancer in Australia. And in fact, Australia is often considered to actually contribute more patients per head of population, perhaps, than most other countries. So people actually do quite well in Australia, but it's a little bit patchy. You can go places to get your treatment and nobody's interested in clinical trials, which is why it sometimes is worth asking that question. I think I've got one more slide. So what have trials achieved? Well, the biggest thing is that they've achieved a 25% reduction in mortality from breast cancer in the last 20 years. But they've also helped to improve quality of life and how we handle that. And like Leslie says, I think people handle chemotherapy better nowadays because of trials showing how to look after side effects. There's some of the areas of treatment, particularly surgery, where we've been able to reduce the amount of surgery that's required. years ago when I trained as a medical student, we were involved in a trial where people were allocated either to have a mastectomy or to have the lump cut out and the radiotherapy. So back then, everybody used to have mastectomies until that trial showed that, well, actually, it wasn't necessary. You could have the lump and the radiotherapy. So that's another sort of thing that trials can do. And I think that they're beginning to head us towards what we might call personalized treatment. We're getting to know more details about each individual cancer and then working out a schedule that would be suitable for patient A and a completely different schedule for patient B. And trials are where we're getting the information to try to do that. I think the last one's just a graph that shows for several countries, and I'm sorry that Australia's not here, and it's for several cancers as well, but you see over there the blue on the right-hand side, this is USA, which is probably the most similar to Australia, that the blue line near the top is the death rate from breast cancer and how it's dropped really about since 1990. And now look, that'll be from lots of reasons, but all of it relates to having had trials to show valuable things to do. It'll be chemotherapy, tamoxifen, it will be screening as well, and picking things up earlier. So that's very impressive and very encouraging. And we wouldn't be able to do it without all the women who have been in clinical trials. So a big thank you to all of them. And thank you to those of you who are about to be in one. And hopefully you'll get an opportunity. Yes. And you might get another opportunity. Yeah.
I'd just like if you could join me in thanking Jackie and Leslie very much for their time today.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.